I guess we'll start by thinking it's really awesome to have the North Pacific Council in Homer. And for me, being somewhat recognized is like kind of weird, but anyway. I'm just another guy that there's 30 other guys out here in this crowd that I know that have stories that would last you a lifetime if you wanted to listen to them. And I guess they figure I'm the biggest bullshitter in the whole crowd, so so they elected me to come do this crap. So here I am. And I've done it a number of times for Islands and Oceans on Seabirds and different groups of people that I've done this at the church and a couple other places. So I'm kind of hard to figure out. The wheelhouse to wheelchair thing is I fished for 33 years or something. Before I was injured in a car accident, and I broke my neck at C4, which is right about your Adam's apple. And when you're C4, I didn't even know what a quadriplegic was. I mean, I never been around anybody even in a wheelchair, and it was like, holy cow! All of a sudden, our whole life just like turned upside down, and for my family and my wife and son, it was like, ooh, too much, you know? I mean, it was like over the top, because I figured my whole life I was invincible. I mean, I don't need to get all choked up about this, but it's hard to talk about, especially when you've had an accident, then it's really hard to talk about. And I've had a number of them in my life, and I thought that I was Mr. Invincible when I was 15, 18, and I was had a super ego, thought I could not be stopped, and I learned the other way around about that. But anyway, getting on to the fishing story, and just to tell you a little bit about quadriplegia, which I didn't know anything about what a quadriplegic was. My injury is at my Adam's apple, C4 and C5, which is a cervical spine. Christopher Reeve was C3, C4. He lived on a respirator for the rest of his life until he died. And I was just one below that. So C4 controls your hands and your fingers, and anything below that is C5, 6, 7, 8, and then you go down onto your spine. So somebody in the back is waving. Can you not hear? Are you just being a heckler? I know those hecklers back there. Okay. Anyway, so just to give you a little more information about spinal cord injury, when you injure yourself at the level that I did, it was like 4 months in rehab, 3 months in critical care. All I can tell you is it sucks. It's not fun. And it's, here's my wife, Barbara, of 42 years. And she's my angel. She's my angel. I got to watch out being too emotional here. But anyway, let's get on with the bullshit that I got to tell you about. So I'll go on with that. I just wanted you to know that from a spinal cord injury at my level, I have no feeling below my armpits. I have no sense of temperature. You can put my hand in boiling water. We went to UCLA and dedicated ourselves as a dummy, a test dummy for a group of 200 people, and had every scientist, every smart person in the world working on me. And I told him, I said, all I want is my hands. Just give me my hands back. And 3 years living in L.A., and they couldn't do it. So I told him, all right, I'm going back to Homer, and I'm going to learn to live my life living in a wheelchair, because I thought I was going to get up and walk again. And that never really happened. So, you know, there's somebody got to brush my teeth, feed me every day, pick me up, put me in a wheelchair, put me in bed, you know, Hoyer lift overhead. Barbara does all that. We have a caregiver that helps us 5 hours a day, and she's awesome. And it's kind of hard for me because Barbara has to live my life, and I don't like that. But that's the way it is. So that's what we do, and we just live day to day and try to get by. And this community, and I mean, there's like been five doctors been to my house and make house calls. I mean, it's just unbelievable the people that reach out to me. Fishermen that I haven't talked to in 20 years, because once we started with the Judy B, we were catch a processor, then we were brand X. We had no relations with any of the buyers or anything else. We had our market in Japan, so we dealt with Japan. And they, you know, so all these guys that were my sailing buddies and everything I dealt with the Invader years ago, I was like gone for 25 years because we were out in the Aleutians with the Judy B. And it was like we were just one boat, one catcher processor. We didn't have any partner boats. And that's kind of the way it all started and the way it all worked out. So anyway, Barb's giving me, opening my computer, so I'll see where I'm at so I'm not jabbering too long here. Okay, I'm off on a tangent. All right, so we're gonna move on to our start. I grew up on the Chesapeake Bay as a kid. That was the first 18, 20 years of my life. But my big brother took me to Alaska when I was 11, and he and I drove a pickup truck, and we had a canoe on top, and we went all the way across Canada, and we fished and canoed and made 3 weeks across America into Alaska. And I'm thinking, holy cow, look at this place. And I grew up in a little town that was called Pocosin, and it was an Indian name for low swamplands. And all the fishermen there on the Chesapeake Bay, they had biceps like footballs, and they had hands like catcher's mitts. And I mean, these guys were just like the toughest, and I just loved that. I thought that was the coolest thing I ever seen, and I wanted to be one of them. But it was like 1970, and their industry in the Chesapeake Bay of being oyster fishermen, crab fishermen, was dying. So then when I came to Alaska with my big brother at 11, and then I came back when I was 15 and when I was 16 in the summers, I don't know how my mom and dad let me even go with him, but he was my mentor, and it was like awesome. And we took off, and here we go across Alaska, and we put the canoe on that camper shell, and away we went. And so I came back the other two summers. In the meantime, in the summers, I would fish with a commercial waterman there, and I just loved it. And so then I guess after that point in time, I came back after I graduated from high school. Then I had to figure out if I was going to Alaska or I was going to get a college degree. And I ended up going into an apprentice program for 4 years as a shipwright. And that was the biggest shipyard in the world at the time. And they started in like 1890, when there were still square riggers in the dry docks. And so I worked there for 4 years. There was no summer break, so I could not come back to Alaska, which was kind of killing me. I wanted to come back to Alaska, but I finished, got my degree, and you get a two-year degree after 4 years of no summer break, but half the day you were in the classroom, half the day you were on the ship with an apprentice instructor. And so they were the number one apprentice program in the nation at the time, and there was like only 800 of us. And the guys that were really good in school, they sent them straight to MIT after 2 years because they figured they were going to be their draftsmen and their designers and their engineers coming down the line, because they were building nuclear aircraft carriers and submarines and every kind of thing. So when I got out of there after 4 years, the day I graduated, I boogied to Alaska because I already knew what it was. And Barbara happened to be the secretary at the apprentice school for 800 guys who were apprentices, and that was the days when she was wearing hot pants. So So every guy in the whole place was after the three girls that were working in the office, right? And so I had had a long relationship with another girl in high school, and I said, look, we got to break this off because I'm going to Alaska when I get through. And so we did, and about a month before I left, I met Barbara. And I went, oh, man, don't do this. So I told her when I left, I packed up the day I graduated, and I packed up and drove to Alaska. And I told her, I says, well, maybe I'll send you a plane ticket. So after about 3 months of being here, my brother sent me up into the wilderness up there to build a camp with Kevin Seidlinger and myself. And we went up there, and it was 49 inches of snow on the lake. And Barbara's sending me letters from Virginia, and Bill LaCreft's dropping them in an airplane, you know, and we're living up there in the snow and trying to build a cabin. And when we got out of there, man, I sent her a plane ticket immediately. And her poor mom, she thought, oh my God, you're going to go up there with igloos and Eskimos and polar bears. And her family was like four generations old in the East Coast, you know, and those people, they never moved. They never left. You know, it was like, what are you doing? So she came up. She told me I'm going to spend 1 year. And I picked her up on the Homer Spit in a Lund skiff with a 15-horsepower motor. And she had just flown all the way from Virginia with three suitcases. And I took her back across the bay into China Poot, where Mike and Diane had already started. And that's kind of where it all began. So where are you on pictures there? Yeah, you can move that one. So these pictures, that was the first place we ever had right there. And Mike and Diane gave that to us as a wedding present and a piece of land that it was on. And that's where we started. And 10 years later, we kind of developed it into that next picture. And 30 years later, we developed it into that picture. And on the next picture, I think you can see the old pilot house sitting on the dock, and that's the pilot house off of the Invader that was built in 1923 that Dan Verhuizen and Debbie had bought and asked us to be partners in. So we took the pilot house off of there, put it on my dock, and turned it into a sauna, which probably quite a few of you have been in and out of through the years and probably don't want to admit it, but anyway. And from there, this was the first skiff I ever purchased. Go back one. Oh, you got it, Barb. Yeah, right there. And there's my grandson and me in the wheelchair there. It's sitting in my front yard because we retired it after I flipped it over. And we'd been in China Poot for 7 or 8 years. It was probably 8 years before Barb and I could even talk about this. It was so freaking scary to all of us that it was, you know, his son, maybe all of you have had a tragic moment in your life and you just can't go back there. You don't want to remember it, or it's just like you block it out. Just like my rollover accident when I was injured in a car accident. We rarely ever talk about that. It's pretty scary stuff. But anyway, that skiff, my dad loaned me $500 and it was $1,800. And a guy in Kodiak, Ed Opheim, built the skiff. And at that time, that was a skiff to have in Homer, Alaska. And we thought it was awesome. And anyway, I'd put a center console in it and got it all dolled up. And that's the remains of it after I flipped it over in China Poot Rip. Peacemaker. And its name was the Peacemaker from China Poot. And so one morning, I'm ready to leave the cabin. And it's blowing. It had been a nasty night out. Dave Brand called me up and said he had a moose down out at Fox River. And he said he saw a brown bear right before he was taking his meat, his first quarter of meat out. And I said, well, I'll come over there and help you in the morning and we'll get it out of there. So the next morning I get up, go out in the front in China Poot, which is very notorious, known rip in sandbars and very dangerous. But I mean, I've been living there, so you know, I know everything there is to know about China Poot Bar, right? So, and it's October about right now, and I looked, and boy, there was a standing rip across the whole sandbar, except where the channel went out. So I stopped, and I idled, and I counted the waves, and I watched the break, and it was a period of 7 waves, and when the 7th wave came through, then I darted into that that rip that was like maybe as wide as that this room is. And I had to get through there to get out, and that was the only deep water. Everything else was sand. And right when I moved into the rip, here comes a big comber and catches me. And so I go up and over it and quarter it on the bow so I wouldn't get flipped. And I thought, okay, I'm going to make it through this green water. And it was a place that wasn't ripping. And then as soon as I looked again, here comes another one. So I had to run like 50 yards from the breaker to try to get the green water to get over the top of it. When I got over the top of it, the next one just swallowed me and took me up on the side. I tucked my head and went in the water and thought, the console or the boat's going to hit me when we're in the water. And it didn't. Make a long story short of this, I swam back to the boat. 100 yards from me was the cliffs of Moosehead Point at the entrance to China Poot that were going to be a meat grinder. And I had a Stormy Seas jacket on, and it had a pull cord for your CO2 to blow your vest up. But I had just come back from Dutch Harbor, and the flight at the security took the CO2 chamber from me, because you can't have that on the boat, I mean on the plane, right? And me not thinking, I know that, I mean, I should have put a new one in it the next morning. I didn't, so I'm pulling on the cord, it's not working. So I go to the blow-up tube, and I blow the blow-up tube, and the skiff is like the corner of that table right here in front of me. That's all that's sticking out of the water, and the 70-horse engine's holding the boat underwater. And I'm thinking there's an air pocket there, and I grab a hold of it to hold it, and I don't know why, but in those days, they would say you were 15 minutes in the water without a survival suit before it was going to take you out. And I was on the, hanging onto that little point of the boat for an hour and 52 minutes. And I looked at my watch when I turned the boat over, and I told my wife that morning, I said, I'll call you in an hour from the harbor. And I'm thinking, oh, man, I did this just 10 minutes away from the house. I got 50 minutes before anybody's going to start looking. I drifted all the way over towards Halibut Cove, hanging onto that boat, tied the bow line around my wrist because I figured for sure I was lost. And just for some reason, these hands that don't work, they worked just fine. They were holding onto that boat. And I said every prayer in the world, especially to my mom, thinking, oh, man, this is going to be terrible. And next thing you know, here comes these guys out of Peterson Bay in a little aluminum skiff. And they come down and they drive up next to me. And I'm hanging on to the skiff, and they're looking at me, and their eyes are like saucers. And they're looking at me, and I say, hey, did you guys bring the morning paper? I have no idea where that came from. And they're looking at me like, man, they grab me and throw me in the bottom of the skiff, and they cover me up in a tarp, and my teeth are shattering. I'm just rattling, and I say, take me over there to Peterson Bay, right next to the Center for Coastal Studies. The Center for Coastal Studies wasn't there in those days. And I said, just take me to the beach. I can walk home. By this time, Bill DeCraft and the Coast Guard and everybody's flying looking for me. But it was ebb tide, so they're all looking for me going the other way. And there's a back eddy that goes to Halibut Cove. So I'm looking at the Halibut Cove beach thinking, oh, man, I'm really going to get eat up in this spot. These guys pick me up. When they picked me up, I got to the beach. As soon as they hit the ground, I jumped out, and they going, where are you going? Where are you going? I'm going to the lodge. I said, I'm going to the lodge right through this isthmus right here. I'm walking to the lodge, and I got out and started walking, and left them. And they're going, wait a minute. I'm going home. So there was nobody at the lodge. So I start out to the end of where our cabin was, and I never forget hollering through the woods to Barbara. She was crying and screaming for me, hearing my voice, because they'd already been looking for me for an hour. And anyway, I got home, and she stripped me down naked and put me in bed, and we got in bed and just held on each other for 12 hours. And I was fine. And that's the end of that story. We got to keep moving here. I'm talking too much. I wasn't planning on getting all choked up, but I'm telling you, I, okay. We never tell that story, hardly ever. It's too upsetting. So after the Peacemaker, we decided to go to an aluminum boat. Charlie Edwards and myself spent the winter building that. It's now set up where I can take my wheelchair over to China Poot. And that's it about that. And the next boat there coming up is the Invader. And Dan Verhuizen and Debbie Verhuizen asked us to be partners in that boat. And, you know, I felt like in those days I was always a greenhorn and had all these mentors, you know, starting with my brother, and then there's these other guys, and there's people that are teaching me how to do stuff. And so Dan and Debbie asked us to be 10% partners in that, and it was like I had to go to the bank and tell him I was going to give him my skiff and my 300 rifle and my firstborn, you know. And it was like, man, he wasn't wanting to give me very much money, and I'm going, daggone. So anyway, we did that for 4 years. During that time,
tell where the picture is.
Oh, this picture is was painted by Jim Bunsack, and we took this the Invader over to McCarthy's Glacier, over in Nuka Bay where I was tendering, and I drove the boat right up in there next to the ice and got in a raft, and we paddled out and we took the picture, and I think in the pilot house was Barbara and my son. And anyway, then Jim painted it and made it like unbelievable painting. It's hanging in my living room. And it was on the front cover of National Fisherman. The boat was a 1923 seiner in Southeast when they hauled seines by hand. And so Danny and I fished it for crab, and we realized that the boat was kind of weak, so we had to take it to Seattle and get the bulwarks redone. So we put all new steel bulwarks in, new bow stem, and I moved Barbara and the family, and Dan moved his family, and we all go to Port Townsend. We thought, all right, Port Townsend. We go down there. We lived down there all winter and redid the boat and then brought it back up and started fishing again. And that picture of Pat is, he took his first steps on the Invader, and there he is at a galley sink getting a bath. So anyway, after the Invader, I spent with Danny 4 years running it for crab, running it for tendering. We'd go to Togiak, we'd go to Kamishak, we'd go to Prince William Sound when there was the big herring fisheries in those days. And when you go to Togiak, there might be 400 boats, 30 chips all ready for all these herring. And then we were working with Icicle at the time, and Don Giles, who is retired now, but was the head of Icicle, and Ralph Ward, and those guys were all out there with us. And I was following around the Judy B in this little old wooden seiner because I didn't know anything about anything. And the old timer that had the Judy B was named Arvid Blendheim, and he was a Norwegian. And the boat was built in Seattle at Jensen Marine, or Nichols Brothers. And so I got to be good friends with him. He was one of my mentors. He took me under his wing, and everywhere he went, I just followed him like a little duckling. And we were just buying fish from all the seiners that are here in Homer. So during those 4 years, I got to know all you guys that were in town here and was fishing that way. And then 4 years later, I decided that tendering couldn't keep my finances going, and I moved over to midwater trawling in Kodiak. And at that time, then we moved over to Kodiak, and I think Barbara's got some pictures there, but maybe they're not the right ones now. Mine's not showing. All right, go ahead with yours. So that's a picture of the Judy B when she was all painted up and my son standing in front of it. And Arvid, he just kind of helped me all along through the way. And he's an amazing, amazing guy. And little did I know when I was pulling the Invader up next to that boat that it was like, I was going to own this one day? And I'm going, holy cow, how could that ever happen? And so after that happened, I went fishing in the Shelikov because that was right when the Magnuson Act came through, and then we put the Japanese out to 200-mile limit, and there was all these fish in the Shelikov, and all the crabbers in Kodiak and everywhere around were trying to rig their boats up to go fishing midwater pollock in the Shelikov. So we were in the Shelikov And this guy offered me a job to be engineer on a 98-foot bender, and I'm thinking, oh, my God, Pat, you know enough about shipbuilding. You don't ever want to be on a 98-foot bender. I mean, these things were known for rolling over because they were built in Louisiana in the Gulf for shrimping. And a lot of guys brought them to Kodiak, and there was a lot of them. And a whole bunch of them are upside down in the bottom of the ocean right now. And I'm thinking, man, you went because you were going to make this big cruise share and go in the Chelikov. And there was so much fish in the Chelikov that you could drive the entire length of it, and your bottom recorder would never be able to hit the bottom because it was solid pollock, just solid pollock. And there was guys that were new to it, and they'd put their net down in the water for like 30 minutes, and their bag would be so full they could barely lift it to the surface. And then when it came to the surface, it would burst on the surface because of the airbags, and the pollock would break, and they'd lift the bag up to the surface. And there's sea lions and killer whales, and the sea lions are on climbing on the bag and growling and barking at us. And if the wind was right, you'd smell their breath, and it was horrible. And then next thing you know, you'd see the killer whales coming in, and there'd be a sea lion flying through the air where they were flipping them with their tail. And I mean, it was just like this amazing feeding frenzy all over the Chelikov. And so I was in a group that was eight of us that Hugh Riley had started with what they call the Tayo joint venture. And yeah, you can go to that if you want. And anyway, they had, there they are, they're the motherships. So these are the ships that were fishing in our waters until this council got together and said, no more. You can't fish within 200 miles of our limit. We own these waters. So then those ships decided that they'd make a joint venture with the American fishermen, and we would catch the fish and then give them to that big tramper there. Now that's a 300-foot ship with an 80-ton bag going up the stern that we had just given them. And so you'd put your net in the water in an hour, hour and a half, you'd have 80 tons. And it'd be so much fish that the Japanese always wanted a full bag. So there'd be so much fish that you'd let the fish go up into the intermediate net, and when you'd pull it to the stern, you'd open these zippers, and you'd let out 20 tons of pollock that you just caught because you had too many, but you wanted to make sure your bag was full. And then it went on to Japanese tramper. So the weather got really bad in the Chelikov. It was like the most notorious icing conditions in the Chelikov. The night we delivered the last bag to that ship, and they said the temperature was 0 degrees, and it was blowing 100 knots. And the weather was just like ice fog. And when the ship came by us to pick up our bag, he must have drove by us within 50 yards. You couldn't even see him. All we could hear was his exhaust, blah, 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 going by us. And then here comes the buoy. We pick the buoy, hook our bag up to it, let it go, and he'd pull it aboard. And the Japanese captain said to the eight captains that were with us, which was the Hazel Lorraine, the Sea Wolf, the Ocean Dynasty, there was all the big crab boats that had converted for the first time ever to figure out how to catch these pollock. And so everybody's doing, and the captain said, we got to move, it's too cold. We were right off Poali Bay, which is a notorious spot for 100-mile-an-hour winds. And we all decided that we weren't going to leave. The captains decided they didn't want to leave. The fishing was too great, and we fished another few hours, and then they said they're not taking any more fish. So we all tried to jog to the beach to get out of the northwest that was coming over the Katmai and all through that country, and that's the pictures you see there. But anyway, that's me and the skipper, and we're all iced up, and we didn't even know what to do. And so we jogged towards the beach, like we're all a mile off the beach, but we couldn't get to the beach. The skipper went to bed, and he gave me the wheel, and he said, all right, just keep jogging. I'm looking through a little spin window you couldn't hardly see out of, and finally I woke him up, and he says, well, let's go out in front. And we looked, and there's like 8 inches, 10 inches of ice on the deck. And we're going, man. So all the boats decided that we were going to turn around and go the 30 miles across the Chelikov, open water, to the Kodiak side, because it was just too cold on the mainland. So we all turned around and went, and Mel Wick and the Alert were one of the smallest boats that were with us. He was about 80 or 90 foot. The Sea Wolf, which was 125 foot state-of-the-art Marco boat at the time, three stories. Bob was saying, I can't get the boat to steer. The steering's not right. Everything's going crazy here. You know, it's too much ice. And so all those, everybody decided to go out and chip ice off the boats to clear the deck. Well, here I am on this bender, which is the worst thing in the world you could be on. And the only good thing about that bender was is the bulwarks were pipe. They had pipe rails around the bow. No 3-foot bulwarks like the Judy B has or all the Marco boats had. So we could take a big colon bar and stick it down into 8 inches of ice, and you'd break off a flake as big as that table right there, and then just slide it off the bow. Well, all the other boats had to lift it over the bulwarks. And it was like, no way, you know. And you're out there working and working. I was going right at the front of the house and the windows with a big bar. And, I mean, it was so much ice, it was incredible. And we got it all off, and then we headed across. Next morning we wake up. And as we're going, one of the guys that I admired was the Alert. Mel Wick was the owner, and he had all Kodiak crew. And he's telling me on the radio, because I was on watch that night going back across, and he's telling me on the radio, he said, my doors are froze up, my antennas are breaking off, my radar's not turning. And he says, you know, we're just too iced up. And it was like he was getting real depressed. And all the crew was, when that happens, for some reason, the crew all wants to go to sleep. Because they've been working all night, right? And they just want to, it's just like get in a bunk and just, you know, forget this. And he's telling me that the radios, and so he was breaking up on the antenna. Well, come to find out, I was the last guy to talk to him. When we all get over to Halibut Bay on the Kodiak side, we all wake up in the morning, there's no Alert. And we're going, holy cow. Well, they were all lost. The boat rolled over. I don't think anybody got out. And he, of all people, had a life raft built into his dash, an extra one. But I don't think he ever got it out of there to get it out of the boat because the boat was so frozen up. And it was a huge disaster to Kodiak. I mean, they were all Kodiak people. They were longtime family there. And the next morning, the captain of the Zuyo Maru, the big ship, shaved his head because that was traditional. If you ever lost any other ship that was with you, that's what they did. And they searched for 3 days and never found anybody or anything. So that was kind of that's my Shelikov story. That's a picture of the Sea Star, I think, 125-foot Marco or 108-foot Marco that was all iced up when we woke up in the morning. And as you can see, it's ice fog, so you can't even really, you know, it didn't make a very good picture. I got to have a sip of my cocktail, like you.
Mm-hmm. What year was that?
Whoa.
The Alert?
82, maybe? Right in there somewhere.
Hi, Papa.
Hey, buddy boy. Anyway, so I guess the next part I needed to go to was the Judy B.
Oh, we already did.
Yeah, well, you can go back to it if you want. But anyway, so Kelly Brennan, who grew up in Halibut Cove, very good friend of mine, and I had been on this midwater pollock trawling, which I did not like. And I thought, oh my God, these guys are going to kill this fishery because we're bleeding off extra fish. And, you know, it was so much fish in the Shelikov. And I'm thinking, how are they ever going to do that? Now, this North Pacific Council, they've managed that. This was 30 years ago. They've managed that pollock resource. In the Bering Sea, those pollock fishermen are doing great. And it's still a very, very, very prolific resource to this day. And I thought, man, when I saw it in the Shelikov, I'm getting out of here. This is not going to last any time for longevity. But in the Shelikov, pollock are pretty much, I don't know what that resource is doing now. But the Bering Sea, I mean, it's like amazing that those guys still catch that much fish every year and it's still going strong. It's a very, very good resource. So anyway, when I decided I was going to get off of that, I decided that Kelly Brennan, who was over in Halibut Cove, he wanted me to start black cod fishing with him because he had a market in Japan. And the first guys that had a market in Japan were Jubilee Fisheries out of Seattle. And they had a boat doing it, and it was like brand new, you know, freezing fish on board and sending them to Japan and actually getting money for it and how you're going to get them to pay and all the rest of it. And so we jumped into it together, and we're trying to find a boat, and we couldn't find a boat. And, like, fishing season's going to start, and we don't have a boat. Neither one of us had a job. So I called up Arvid, who owned the Judy B in Seattle, and said, Arvid, what do you think? Would you ever consider you selling your boat? And it was right at the time when the king crab fishing in the Bering Sea took a real bad spike down. And Arvid was 50. His dad, Agni Blendheim, was 60. And his brother-in-law was 70, I guess. So he said, no, Pat, he said, I don't think we're ready to sell a boat. And I'm going, well, okay, you know, I understand. And he said, if I did, I'd want $1 million for it. And I'm going, holy crap, you know, where are we going to get $1 million? So Kelly and I are stumbling around, and we're talking to all these different boat owners and different things. And Kelly had already been doing it with the Kamchatka Queen and been very successful. And at that time, I didn't know anything about a black cod, except I knew how to do pots and all that sort of thing. And he was thinking, because of the killer whales, that we ought to go to pots. So we're going to take pots and go into Aleutians and knock them dead, we thought. Wrong. But anyway, next thing I know, 2 weeks later, I get a call from Arvid Blendheim. And he says, my dad wants you and Kelly to come down here and talk to us. So we fly down to Ballard, go into a little old Norwegian community in Ballard. And, I mean, we went in the living room with Dad, and his mom's name was Clarice Blendheim. His wife's name was Judy Blendheim, thus Judy B. The boat was named. And we go and sit down with the 80-year-old father and son and nephew at their table with the little doilies and the china set, and Grandma brings out the tea, and we're going, where's the beer, Grandma? And it's like, holy cow, you know, and we're telling them about what we think we can do. Lo and behold, they owner financed us for $1 million boat at 12% interest, because it was 10% plus 2 for interest. And we signed on the line. I was 30, Kelly was 25, and they let us have their boat. And then we had to convert a crab boat into a catcher processor, freezer longliner, which is untanked. And from everything I learned when I was a kid running around crab boats, you do not move a crab boat out of the harbor unless it's tanked full of water, because the stability's gone. So I worked with Jensen Maritime and all the engineers to figure out the weight and the balance, and somehow or another we pulled it off. So that turned into our success. Everything else was kind of stumbling grounds. And when we had the Judy B for 23 years, I think, the 5-8 years before IFQs came into being, we were just fishing black cod wherever we could fish black cod. And I think, I have it written in my logbook, but I think over those 7 or 8 years, we fished 280 days at sea with the boat. So, and we'd make 40-day trips, and I had another relief skipper, Rich Lauer, and sometimes I'd make 90-day trips, 240s. Some of the crew would make 240-day trips. And we'd come back to Dutch Harbor. Barbara would have all the stuff arranged to meet with the Japanese tramper. So we never went to the Dutch Harbor dock. We offloaded 40-pound frozen blocks of black cod right straight to the tramper. Then I'd go on board with the captain, sign the papers. And they were just anchored off of Dutch Harbor in the bay there, in Captain's Bay. And then Barbara would do all the bill of lading and up all night because the Japanese time versus our time and all that sort of stuff. And 2 weeks later, we'd get a check. And they were very trustworthy and treated us great, and had Barbara and I and Kelly and I over to Japan 2 or 3 different times. And, geez, you couldn't buy a piece of bubble gum. They spent, everything was paid for. And then when I went home, I looked at Barbara one day and I went, damn, that must have cost them $10,000. And then I went, I think we paid for that one way or another, indirectly. So that's kind of what happened with the Judy B. then all a lot of these guys who I got to make a shout out to everybody in this community. I mean, it has been amazing. The people that have reached out to me and helped me, like incredible. Even from my hometown that I grew up with in high school, the stuff they reached out is just incredible. I mean, there's fishermen in my house every Friday, every Thursday at 5 o'clock to have a little cocktail, and we tell a bunch of lies like I'm doing now. And we just have a grand old time. And I mean, some of these guys, I haven't seen them for 30 years because when we turned Catch a Processor, we were brand X. We had no cannery. We had nobody to support us. So when we came to Dutch Harbor, we just went to the ship, offloaded our product, went to the dock, reprovisioned, changed crew in 5 days, and back out for another 40. And most of that time, I think 1 year we painted the anchor in, when they spray painted the boat, that real nice picture you saw of the Judy B. I don't think the anchor went down for like 3 or 4 months. We just stay offshore, and when the blows came, we just sit and jogged and waited for the weather to go by. And as soon as the weather went by, we started fishing again. And it was low after low after low. We'd leave here every year December 28th. So the crew didn't like it too much because they had to cut their Christmas short and get on a boat. And we'd be in Dutch Harbor on January 1, and there was great black cod fishing at that time right outside of Dutch Harbor by 6 hours. And we'd just run right out there in January 1. And one time we came by Shoshalin Volcano, and the orange is running down into the seawater when we're coming by the volcano, and it was like, holy cow, you know. And we just, then the rest of our time for the next 20 years, we were basically in the Aleutians, except the Gulf was only, the Gulf was open for a month and a half. So, of course, we went and did that. But what I tell everybody is fishing in the Gulf of Alaska is like a pony ride in May sunshine versus fishing in the Aleutians. Aleutian has tremendous current and coral bottom. And the bottom looks like the mountains you see right across there. Everywhere there, the whole bottom is very mountainous, and underwater volcanoes and everything like that. So it's really, really hard to learn how to fish in that country. So we were one of the first ones that did it, Kelly and I, and there was the Republic. Dewey on the Republic was out there at the time. He was one of the only halibut schooners, because most of the halibut schooners couldn't take that ice cold weather. The first year we had the boat, we overheated the engine and cracked the block. And the owners had a spare engine that we got shipped to Dutch Harbor, put back in. We're out there at the home, at out the spit in Dutch Harbor, which if you ever been out there, you don't want to spend a lot of time there in the wintertime. But anyway, we had 33 crew members that year. They were jumping off of there like flies, you know. We broke down, pistons laying on the deck, and me and my other mentor, Herman Schmidt, who was a German engineer and a mechanic for all my engines, was there. And it was like the first year was tough. So where am I going here, honey?